Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to the Couple Speak Relationship Forum on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist and coach and founder of the Couple Center and Couple Speak in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I come to you live alternate Wednesdays at 9 p.m. I've got a great episode tonight, February 9th, called Uncover the Truth, Hire a Private Investigator. I've been very excited about the show and very eager to start. So joining me tonight as my guest is Frank Santon, Senior Investigator and co-owner of National Private Investigative Services in Dover, New Hampshire. Frank has been a PI for many years, also working for major law firms in criminal and family law cases. His website, if you want to reach him, is investigativeservicesllc.com. First, some technical issues. Your toll-free call-in number is 877, let's see, what is it, 497-9046. All callers will be muted unless you have a question or comment, which will save probably for the last 15 minutes. Then, just as in school, raise your hand by pressing 1, and you'll be on the queue to be on the air. At some point tonight, we may open the lines for everyone to be on the air with us if you're not too unruly a crowd, and if we have enough time. So, Frank, how are you?
I'm well, Susan. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, I'm so glad to have you. I've been so looking forward to you being on the show. And I want to let the viewers know how I found you, okay, how we met.
Okay.
It was, I think, about 6 years ago. Frank, let me just ask you a question. Do I sound clear to you? Because I've got my headset on, and I'm not sure if it's keyed in.
No, nope, very fine. No problem.
Oh, okay, good. Okay. I'm still getting through all the technical stuff with this. But we met about 6 years ago, I think it was, maybe 7 years ago. And it was really kind of funny because I had had a number of clients who were very suspicious of their husbands or wives, wondering what was going on in their marriage. And it was driving them crazy, not knowing whether there was something fishy going on. And I ended up saying something which was very unconventional for me as a psychotherapist. I said to some people, if it's really driving you that crazy and you feel like you need to know, why don't you just hire a private investigator? And then I was deluged with all these questions which I couldn't answer. So I don't remember exactly how I got to you. I think you were working for, Jeffco and Star Branch at the time?
Yes, originally I started out exclusively to that law firm, and it expanded from that point on where more and more attorneys became aware of our services and utilized us, especially in a large volume of marital cases.
Yep. And I think you just had a great reputation, and so I contacted them. I had heard about the fact that there was a really good private investigator working with them, and we had lunch, and I think that's when I asked you my 10 million questions, right? We had the most hilarious lunch.
I think both of us went from one scenario to another, and I think we were equally surprised at the insight that the other one had on these kind of circumstances.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Well, it was funny because I had the feeling about private investigators that I think a lot of people have, that it's all shrouded in mystery and smoke and mirrors. It's kind of this, it felt almost like an underworld kind of thing. It was very mysterious and very different and completely foreign to me. And I know when I met you, you made the whole thing really make sense to me, and it kind of humanized it. So I'm hoping that's what we can do tonight on the show. And I'm wondering if you could start by saying something about how you got into this very, very, I think of it as odd, maybe it's not odd to you, but how did you get into this occupation, Frank?
Well, I worked for 24 years as in law enforcement. I'm a retired Dover police officer, and my last 8 years or so there, I was a prosecutor for the department, and just became more and more involved, not only in the investigative end, but in the court process. And instead of, when it came about time to retire, instead of branching into something totally new, I decided to stay with what I knew and expand from that point, and I haven't looked back. So for the last, I retired in 2002.
Yeah.
So for the last 9 years, I've been doing private investigative work.
Okay. And do you think that, I'm wondering if you kind of came to this work with a certain either curious or kind of suspicious disposition, does it require that? Or is that sort of inherent in police work?
I think it's a little bit of everything. You take your life experience with the law enforcement background, and it's a natural transition to get into areas of inquiry. I've always liked solving mysteries and puzzles and applying that to practical circumstances where it's of value and use to the people that use it.
Right. And so it's really problem solving, a lot of figuring things out.
Very much so. Probably like your business, I'm required to wear several hats in the course of dealing with clients because they are oftentimes in crisis and have a feeling of helplessness with not the strong familiarity with the court process and the system, and being forced into the system because of an issue with their relationship, or just having some concerns that they don't know how to solve it, they don't know how to resolve it, and that's when they come to me.
Yeah. I find that people often are kind of agonizing over things that seem apparent to them, and then their partner is, and if they're in a if it comes from a relationship, their partner is negating it, and it makes them feel crazy. And the need to know the truth kind of overrides how they get to the truth. And I guess
very
I'm wondering, is that, do you see that a lot?
Yeah, very much so. In fact, we have clients who are well into the divorce process and still have questions about the background of the breakup of their marriage, and utilize us to get to the bottom of it.
Okay, so they really want to know what the true story is.
Correct.
Historically,
in relationships, the private investigator was singularly sought out for infidelity issues, and that trend has changed and branched into a couple of different areas, as well as the stereotypical wife who comes to hire the private investigator concerned about her husband.
Yeah.
In the past, you know, I'd have 90% women clients, and now we run about 50% men and women. It's certainly a two-way street, and both sides are equally curious when it comes to the issue of infidelity.
Okay, so infidelity is a big source of people kind of making the entry point in your business.
It is. It used to be 90% of the reason people came to see myself or someone like me, and now it's has branched also into asset hiding, which has become as commonplace as infidelity when it comes to the breakup of a marriage.
I hear about more couples who are in a divorce where the attorney is hiring a forensic accountant to find out about hidden assets because they feel like they're about to get screwed or they're getting screwed. Something's obviously very secretive. And I'm wondering, Do you work with forensic accountants, or, I mean, which part would you do and which part would they do about finding out about assets?
Oftentimes we're ahead of the forensic accountant in that people utilize us on the front end to conduct general inquiry both into the asset issue as well as the infidelity issue. And the forensic accountant is often called into play further along in the divorce process when the numbers are crunched. There is a process in divorce called interrogatories. And interrogatories are a formal set of questions that are required of one of the parties or both of the parties in a marital circumstance. And their focus is official questions relative to financials.
Right.
And it is often found, and surprisingly how often, that people lie in the interrogatories in part to hide assets. So their disclosures are less than candid, and we have encountered some pretty elaborate and sometimes very clandestine ruses by folks when hiding assets. And we had one particular case where the wife had hired us, was concerned about financials because they did not seem to add up. And we were able to discover that the individual, the husband, worked out a plan with a friend of his who was in the antique business to actually issue checks to the friend under the premise that they were for the purchase of furnishings and a dining room set and office furniture when it was all fabricated. There was no movement of the furniture. It was strictly him moving money across the table, so to speak, for his friend to safeguard and make it look like he was investing in furnishings and antique pieces when it was all a cover-up to hide the money.
So very involved, very carefully thought-out deception, it sounds like.
Oftentimes, one spouse will think they're smarter than everybody else and engage in a practice with the purpose to hide money.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, once a trained investigator works with the other spouse to get to the bottom of the financial cover-ups, we're a very high frequency of success.
It sounds like you really help create a more even playing field in divorces so that whatever is veiled is now, it comes to the light of day, and that if people are being very sneaky and secretive, they're less likely to get away with it, so that the judge can make a more informed decision.
Oh, very much so. It resolves two purposes. The first is that it discloses the true financial status, hopefully, of the relationship. And second, it exposes the other side to the court that they're taking illegal and often sly steps to avoid responsibility in the breakup of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
All divorces, regardless of any state, have a financial component to them, and the evaluation of assets to be divvied up by the two sides is a critical component to, you know, fair play. And oftentimes, it's the aggressive partner in a relationship that is manipulating the money to his or her advantage, and it takes another set of eyes to uncover the secrets.
Are there any other kinds of relationship issues where your services are needed beside that?
Yes, quite often these kind of circumstances, the custody component, when children are involved, brings us into play on the fitness issue. What I mean by that is the concern of the courts when placing children with one spouse or the other, or determining what who should have custody, split custody, shared custody, and the creation of the so-called family plan to give that an official sanction, still has a component whereby the judge is seeing two folks dressed up nicely, looking their best, with attorneys in the courtroom in a clinical type of atmosphere, and it often becomes very difficult to decide as accusations float back and forth across the table who is the most fit or who is unfit to be involved in the raising of the children. And oftentimes we are engaged to identify and expose unfitness issues with regard to the spouse in custody cases. So in marital, that's the most common three components is infidelity, asset hiding, and fitness with regard to the custody of children.
So you're really protecting this huge protection element in your work that one wouldn't ordinarily think of in your work, protecting fairness, protecting the interest of the children, in ensuring that things are done in a that information comes out so that there are more even-handed decisions about these things.
Very much so. There, New Hampshire utilizes GALs, which is an acronym for guardian ad litem.
Yeah.
It is a person appointed by the court to act as a somewhat of a go-between, but as a guardian for the children to help the court evaluate the actual status of the family. And oftentimes the guardians are restricted by announcement, scheduling, and other clinical components that unless they are a good interviewer, unless they are a good evaluator of persons at face value, then they're going to have a difficult time and often do not have a full set of facts to make the decisions that are necessary in determining the status of children. And in our business, we utilize surveillance.
I was going to ask you what kind of methods you use,
Yeah, in those cases, it depends on the spouse giving us the leads that indicate lifestyle and circumstance and allow us to look for those opportunities where we can see a true picture of what, in fact, is going on.
So surveillance would be one. How else do you get your information?
Interviews of acquaintances of the persons involved, contact with things like work schedules, confirming employment, evaluating. One example would be substance abuse, which plays a role in a significant amount of failed marriages. In that regard, when it comes to the custody of children, we have several times a year we'll get cases where one side or the other may abuse either drugs or alcohol. And surveillance is not the only opportunity for us to get to the bottom of things, but looking at the person's lifestyle and routine may in fact expose what is really happening.
Okay, so through information that you can access about whether they're working, where they're working, how much money they're spending, et cetera?
Correct, where they're hanging out.
Okay.
If, for example, we find out that the spouse is spending a significant amount of time at a local watering hole or has a lifestyle consistent with that profile, that becomes very, very important. We did a case recently where we, my partner, Sue Smith, and I will engage in undercover activities to, in fact, put ourselves in positions where we actually can be hands-on and engage directly the other spouse in contact and observation and extension of the surveillance to, in fact, determine what kind of things that they're up to.
So you would pose as someone else in a situation to bring out whatever that person under suspicion is doing?
Absolutely. Very common, where we just pose as average, everyday people, put ourselves in position of observing, not just, you know, from a telescope hundreds of feet away, but up close and personal in that establishment that turns out to be a habit to actually see and participate and interact with the individuals that are the focus of the investigation to see for ourselves. The proof is in the pudding.
Yeah, Frank, this is unbelievable. It sounds like it's in the movies where you put on all these different hats, you wear disguises, you assume different characters. I'm sure it's never boring for you.
It's very engaging because you have to find ways to put yourself in the position where you don't attract undue attention onto yourself, but yet get the job done in a practical way to find out the truth of what's going on. We investigated an employee of a local restaurant who was swearing to the judge and the court that he was going to AA, was not drinking, had turned things over a new leaf, and was doing things appropriately. And after a relatively short time, not only was he continuing his drinking ways, but he was in fact at a local establishment as an employee and drinking while he was working. And we were able to discover and expose that kind of lifestyle that tells something about what he represented to the court and also about his credibility.
Now, does it ever, in the uncovering of this information, I would imagine there must be some risk to either you or to the client who's hired you. Is that true?
Risk to the client, no. I mean, the spouse that's pulling a fast one, that has a secret lifestyle, or is conducting themselves in a way contrary to what they represent, is not happy when it gets exposed. We have been the subject of, a number of opportunities and circumstances that are not for everybody. But the client has lived that life, knows the circumstances, and it's no real surprise to them.
Mm-hmm.
But their presentation to the court is now corroborated by independent means.
Okay.
And so from that standpoint, there's no risk to the client because this is something that's been going on for some time. They certainly get mad at us when it gets exposed. And we testify in court as to our observations and the circumstance. But, you know, that kind of goes with the territory.
Yeah, I would imagine. Now, this is a question I know clients have asked me, whether all the methods are legal. For instance, is it legal to tap someone's phone? Where is the line drawn legally? What's admissible in court, et cetera? And I'm wondering about that.
Well, in divorce proceedings, you will see a high amount of information allowed in because unlike a criminal case, there is no suppression issues where pieces of evidence or circumstance get excluded because of a lack of a search warrant or some other requirement that's placed on law enforcement. We are not the police. We are not subjected to the same rules as law enforcement.
Oh, wow.
However, that being said, this is not the 1950s where you can just barge into someone's motel room
mm-hmm.
to take the Polaroid shot of the spouse in bed with another person. You have to do things in a professional manner. Even though it's clandestine, it has to be within the rules. And our techniques surveillance, undercover work are well above, well established, and well recognized techniques that are certainly legal. They have a sense of their own secretiveness. We have clients that who are checking into a spouse's secret lifestyle and feel guilty about employing tactics, but they are perfectly legitimate, and those are the ways to discover the information with, within the rules that guide us.
Yeah, I've seen that in my practice where somebody, on a number of occasions, somebody has finally hired a private investigator. I've actually referred some people to you, and where there's a lot of ambivalence about doing it, that it's really interesting that the person who hires the private eye ends up feeling like a perpetrator of some kind, and partly because they've broken the bond. It's kind of a collusion of nobody, I don't say anything, you don't ask any questions. And there often is a little bit of shame about I'm going to sort of underhanded, there's a feeling that it's kind of underhanded ways to find out information. And in my work with people, I try to reassure them that if the information were free-flowing and above board, you wouldn't be doing this. And if it wasn't driving you crazy and it wasn't maybe putting you at risk either financially or your child at risk in some way, you wouldn't have to resort to this.
Correct. And I often liken the story that's been around forever where the parent goes through the teenage child's drawers and finds the bag of marijuana in the underwear drawer. And the child makes the big commotion about, geez, Dad, geez, Mom, how dare you go through my things? And the parent is saying, wait a minute, son, you have marijuana in your drawer in our house. And the child is all caught up in going on the offensive and saying, how dare you go through my drawers? Well, how dare you use marijuana? How dare you do this under my roof when I'm trying to raise you to, to be a better person and to be in a better place?
Yeah.
So when in a marital situation there are feelings by the spouse of, whether it's the asset issue or it's the infidelity issue, there are certain things that have already put that person to that point. And those questions won't go away until you have a legitimate assessment if there's a reason to be concerned, if there's a reason to be suspicious. And there is certainly a percentage of time where the concerns are unfounded. Mm-hmm. But more often than not, if your gut is telling you something's wrong, something is wrong.
Absolutely. It happens in a context, and helping people understand that they're not acting in a vacuum.
Correct.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the most common, I go back to the substance abuse issue. Their claims that they're on the right track are immediately met by an investigative step of, okay, well, let's see. Let's go to the places that they hang out. Are they drinking? Are in the trash can is a, empty a case of beer hidden in a black trash bag that's put out so the spouse can't see it. We'll look in that trash can. We'll go to that place and see how they conduct themselves. And is it consistent? And or is it consistent? And is there an issue?
Yeah.
So it's very common.
Oh, absolutely. Now, Frank, are there in your work, are there out of state or out of country issues that are at play here? And I'm asking that question because I'm thinking about a client I had. I've had a few clients actually where it's usually very wealthy, very narcissistic husbands have offshore accounts. They've got, they're hiding money in Colombia or whatever. And it's really very hard to track here in regular ways. And I'm wondering, are there limitations on investigative work in terms of out of state or out of country issues?
There are, and there are certain things that you have to watch for to make sure that you're not being taken advantage of by someone who professes to be a professional private investigator. For example, it is not uncommon at all to utilize out-of-country resources to hide assets. The difficulty in locating those assets is high. It's expensive to determine it. You can't always determine it. And the fact of the matter is, if you determine it, there's not a lot you can do about it.
Are there particular countries where that's true, particular countries that are guilty of that?
One of our cases a couple of years back involves an accidental discovery by the spouse who came to us with paperwork from North Carolina, a financial group, just indicating them that their privacy rights were with regard to their transactions out of their location and a account in the Caribbean, which turned out to be the Cayman Islands.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, the letter that was addressed to my client identified in and of itself that an account had been established utilizing my client's Social Security number. So we assisted the client in contacting the financial institution using her legitimate Social Security number as indicated on the form, and we requested the account status, and we determined that they had brokered an account for the other spouse, in excess of $100,000 in the Cayman Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And that case was uncovered because the spouse used the wife's Social Security number and thought there was no way that that would surface. And he was undermined in actuality by the outfit that sent the letter talking about, ironically, the privacy issue. Now, the difficulty in that case was, as amusing as we thought it was, the client was concerned that it would take several thousand dollars for me to determine this information, let alone the product effectiveness of going to the Cayman Islands to pursue the angle, costing even more money, and to what end. Well, I, in that very first discussion, said there is no sense sending me to the Cayman Islands because even if we confirm the money is there, we can't force that to be turned over, and no court in the United States can effectively enforce it. They can order it, but there's no way that a judge can issue an order to a Cayman bank and say, send half of that money to this woman in New Hampshire because
right.
It belongs to her.
There's no jurisdiction.
So, correct. They have
yeah.
no authority to do that. So even with the steps that we took, we know it was there. That case ended up working out in a different way because of other angles. But if that had been the only issue that had surfaced, you would waste your money on a private investigator even getting that far if you thought it was going to have a successful outcome.
Well, that gets to another question that's come up for clients when they're thinking about hiring a private eye, the cost. And I know when we met for lunch, one of the things that you had said to me was that there are all different kinds of services and different gradations, and you in a way, you undersell. You don't try to over-provide and over-function in the beginning, for instance, 24-hour surveillance. And I'm wondering, could you give listeners some sense of what they could expect the cost to be for the various kinds of services?
Yes, most in New Hampshire, you would probably pay anywhere from $55 an hour to, I think the highest price PI in New Hampshire is, I think, $95, possibly $100
mm-hmm.
per hour. Now, what happens in those cases is you have to determine what the task is involved. For example, you brought up surveillance, which is the most common thing people are interested in when they come to see us. They want to keep an eye on their spouse. They either have a business trip or they have other circumstances that afford an opportunity for the spouse to have a free rein, and they want that person under the microscope, so to speak. And what I tell them is, when you engage in surveillance, there is a need to sit down with the investigator, whoever you hire, and evaluate those opportune times when it increases the probability of success. Because if you have a private investigator tell you that round-the-clock surveillance is in order, I would question whether that fellow or that gal is licensed or legit, because that's not the way it should work, because it won't work. Surveillance is not an exact science, and you could end up watching a person for an indefinite amount of time and still not have a successful result. You don't know what the dynamics are. So what we try to do is we try to identify those time frames when the opportunity for success is high. And we do that based upon patterns of behavior, work schedules, and other activities that are known to be legit and factual within a relationship, and then explore them accordingly. We also employ GPS systems to track the behavior and circumstance of a target, which is much more efficient and much more cost-saving than manual surveillance, which has all kind of pratfalls to it.
So you will put a device on a car, plant a device on a car to see where they've gone?
Correct.
Okay, and where does that get placed so that the driver of the car, the person under suspicion, doesn't become aware of it? For instance, if it's somebody who has a knowledge of cars and likes to tinker with a car, how would you do that so that they don't find it?
Well, in fairness, Susan, I'm not going to be that specific as to where the placement goes, but rest assured that we have we have three different types of GPSs that we use. And those, depending on the circumstances, what type of device is utilized. And in those cases where the GPS is used, we determine after which type is to be utilized as to what the location should be. There are a few variables. It depends on the type of car, the usage by the person, and the activities of the vehicle that will determine that. So there's no one black and white simple answer to that question. Each case is a little bit different. We could, you know, have five cases in a row and have five different scenarios. So needless to say, it's in a place where it's not going to be discovered, hopefully, and that's kind of judged on a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
Sometimes
but you're zeroing in. I'm sorry?
I was just going to say that sometimes the cases are so, the information is so compelling that it causes the client to, in fact, create the most dangerous potential for us, is that they disclose information too soon before we get to remove the device, or before the attorney tells them when to disclose the information, because it becomes emotionally charged once that the truth is identified.
Oh, well, I've seen that. I've seen that in my work, where it becomes a kind of explosive situation. The person who gets found out, you mean, goes into a rage about being discovered?
Well, it's for on our end, what happens is the devices get discovered because, again, there's no need for manual surveillance. And so the guesswork is very quick that, well, how did they know all that information? And in this day and age, with the frequency of the usage of GPS, it doesn't take long for people to convert that they were discovered through the use of GPS. And the next thing that you know, they're checking the car, they're discovering the device, and our devices have been, you can imagine the scenarios. I mean, one of the stories that my staff still gets a chuckle out of, even though it cost us the client the money to replace the unit is we had a unit placed on a vehicle where it was discovered, and the individual that was targeted was friendly with the fellow who worked in a railroad yard. So they put the device on a railroad car, and the next thing we knew is our device was in Canada. And
the traveling device.
Oh, boy.
What
and
happened?
So, most of them are battery operated, and some can be wired to the engine of the car to, maintain a constant power source, but there is an equal number that are battery-powered, and this one ended up, as I say, the last thing I think we knew was it was somewhere in Ontario, and then the battery died a few days later, and that device is probably found by some hobo not knowing what
the
heck
country.
He just located.
Oh, boy.
So,
I work with a client who, she worked with another private eye, and she was living with a very, very paranoid, I think he was a survivalist, a very paranoid, suspicious guy whose whole life was organized around secrecy, and it became very apparent in our work that he was probably not only having an affair, but was committing some real boundary violations with at least one of their daughters. And she was advised to plant initially when she was suspecting him of the affair, to plant a GPS device on his car. And I remember thinking that wasn't the smartest advice by that particular private eye, because he was much sneakier than she could ever be. And I think he kind of figured it out. She was kind of klutzy in the way she planted it and was ill at ease, and I think he figured it out. And what it got to was another issue, which I think comes up in my work, that somebody, when a spouse who hires a private eye, they can use the fanciest techniques in the world, but sometimes the person being watched is so sneaky and so good at it, they're a psychopath or a sociopath, that there's almost no catching them. And sometimes it boils down to what I say to clients is, if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And do you need to actually catch them in the act of this or that to have enough information? Is it enough to just suspect?
Well, we've seen certainly cases where we get engaged probably more frequently than we employ the GPS to detect the GPS. So,
really?
Without question, people in those relationships where they have a controlling partner and there are circumstances with no basis but still find themselves subjected to unexplainable knowledge to their partner about their activities on a regular basis, suspect the employment of GPS, and we get hired to screen their vehicles and sometimes their homes for tracking devices or listening devices, because you will see that in those relationships where the partner is become overbearing and very controlling.
Mm-hmm.
And so what better way to employ a controlling technique but to have a GPS on the partner and to match that up with the stories that they tell about their activities, and also because you can remote access the true time device, so you could at any given time of the day access the unit and figure out where it's at.
Yeah.
And so we've been hired more than once by people in a separated status to check their vehicles because they feel like their ability to move about freely has been compromised.
Yeah. Now, are there any cases that you would not take where, or historically that you have not taken because they felt either too dangerous or you felt like you would be complicit in some way in something that felt too shady?
Yeah, I mean, there's definite scenarios that any legitimate licensed private investigator would avoid. If there is a restraining order against the party, you certainly would not participate in identifying that person's location or making contact. I one time, because of my law enforcement experience, had an early incident in my career as a private investigator where a fellow with a very distinctive name had contacted me about locating his ex-girlfriend so he could serve papers on her to get custody of their child. And this fellow did not recognize my name and did not recognize me when he came to visit me. But I immediately, the name was, again, distinctive, and we determined that this fellow, in fact, had been in jail for stalking this girl and had undertaken to pick up where he left off. So in that particular case, I just told the fellow that I would not assist him, but also alerted authorities that it looked like he was going to pick up his old habits and re-engage. And so, that resulted in a successful intervention against that fellow. But we go through a screening process to make sure that if we are engaged on someone's behalf, it's for a legitimate purpose. And we'll not just, you know, head out there cowboy style and give just people walking in the door without any scrutiny what they ask for.
Yeah, so you don't want to be complicit in something that's either illegal or that's dangerous or that's just unhealthy in some way. So it sounds like that screening is really critical.
It is critical because it's not really the dangerous component for us, because there's an inherent amount of that in any adversarial. You know, we're always getting someone irritated and helping someone else. So for us, that's just part of the business. But we will certainly not do anything that puts our client at risk. And, you know, from that standpoint, we will evaluate every case that comes into the door to make sure that it's a, you know, a legitimate client with a legitimate concern.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes without saying across the board.
Yeah.
We've rejected cases in the past where we just didn't feel right. It just didn't, you know, pass the test of legitimacy. And, you know, we'll avoid those circumstances on a regular basis.
So kind of relying on that sixth sense, or that just kind of intuitive sense, sounds like it's really critical in your work.
Yeah, I think, for applicants that come in to try and work for us or apply for a job or others that we're familiar with, certainly a criteria would be a sense of common sense and an ability to deal with impractical situations in a practical manner.
Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of ability to, you know, ferret out those that are, you know, not compatible with what we do, and certainly as an employee or a client, is critical. And so, you know, we don't take anything at face value.
Yeah, I would think not. Now, Frank, we have other people on the line, but they're a very shy group. Nobody's asked a question, so I'm just going to continue with some of the questions that I have for you. Is that okay?
Sure.
One thing that I think might be useful for our listeners to know is, how would they get access to a private investigator, and how would they know who's legitimate and who's shady?
Well, there's a few ways to gauge that. It's like any, you kind of hit the nail on the head earlier in the conversation when you said that people sometimes have a unclear perspective on what we do and how we do it. And I think what happens is when a person finds himself in a situation where they need someone like us, that any qualified private investigator in the state of New Hampshire is licensed to do so. And therefore, it would always be a practice to ask the person their license number. You can confirm their status with the state relatively easy with a couple of phone calls. And if a person said that they did not have a license, I would steer away from them immediately because it is required to have one in order to perform the service.
Okay, so it's a regulated field, which is great.
It is regulated, and it requires us to be not only licensed but bonded and have a a background screening is done by the state for anyone who engages in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, in my particular case, I had 24 years of law enforcement background. I had 4 years as a military policeman prior to that. And so my credentials were still verified by the licensing authorities, which is overseen by the state police,
mm-hmm.
Before I was issued a license.
Okay.
And so that's one of the first issues. The second is a reference like you would a doctor or a lawyer or any other professional person that, let's face it, the stakes are high. And you want to make sure that you're getting the most bang for your buck because you want to find the information, but you want it obtained legitimately and you want to be able to use it. I mean, the
Absolutely.
Information is useless if it was obtained in such a way that is not credible and not corroborated. And, again, that defeats the purpose of hiring someone. So most attorneys are very familiar with those of us in the field. If a person had an acquaintance that was either in the court system or an attorney, it would be easy enough to call for a reference in that regard. When it comes to private investigators, 90% of my clients are attorneys or full law firms and easy enough to check references.
So people need to do their homework and get a good word of mouth reference, not just open up the phone book and then just point to see whoever is underneath their thumb.
Yeah, that's actually the difficulty is you see a series of ads in the phone book or someplace else. And if you engage, it's always good to do a consult. And if they're working out of the trunk of their car and they don't have a license, every red flag should pop up at that time.
Yeah.
If an established PI within the first 5 minutes, ask the PI if he's licensed, ask him what his license number is. And then you can
okay.
call and verify it. And then go to his business location or hers. Have a consult with them, listen to what he or she has to say, ask about the strategies that are going to be used after you explain what the situation is that you want to look into. And just like you're interviewing to hire someone, this is no different. If you don't feel comfortable with the person that you're speaking with, move on to the next one.
Okay, and the first interview is about an hour. Somebody could expect to have an initial session with you for about an hour?
Yeah, I usually do not charge for the consult if it's a referral from an attorney or an acquaintance or a prior client.
Okay.
We're lucky enough, Sue Smith and I run a business that does not rely on a billboard sign on the Spalding Turnpike.
That's good.
Our clients come to us because generally someone else sent them.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
We like it that way. And
yeah.
So from that standpoint, that's a good measuring stick, and it works two ways. That initial consult helps us figure out if we want you for a client, if
yeah.
what you're doing is legit, if your concern is something that we need to evaluate, and it helps both of us feel comfortable about the business arrangement.
Yeah, I think that's really important to determine a mutual fit always in this kind of a thing. Frank, I'm wondering if you have the same question asked of you that I have asked of me a lot, which is whether or not your work jades you in some way. I know people ask me very often, don't you get either depressed or jaded by seeing so much pain and suffering all the time or seeing the underbelly of humanity? And I know for me, my experience is, no, not at all, because I also see striving and I see growth and courage and all those other things. And I'm wondering, in your work, what prevents you, other than you facilitating a best possible solution in these cases, what prevents you from getting jaded or feeling that the world is just a very dark, secretive, sneaky place?
I think it's kind of twofold. The first part is that we are, you know, when I was working for the police department, I worked for the common good. And when I went into the private sector, I was now working for individuals and their families. And there is a very strong sense of satisfaction that when the truth gets exposed and the circumstances are identified that helps a positive result, that in and of itself is its own reward. And I go into the situation, you know, especially in a marital case, you know, there are two sides to every story.
Oh, man.
If I'm working for one side versus the other, is there an issue there that can help the courts make a stronger and righteous decision on the outcome? That in and of itself is goal worthy. Recently, I had kind of a breath of fresh air when, in an odd kind of way, where this family that had ties to both Massachusetts and New Hampshire had a death in the family of an aunt that was kind of out on her own. Well, one of the relatives, surviving relatives, hadn't been heard from for some time, and so they hired me to track down the relative, and I found him in Vegas, of all places. And this fellow, down on his luck, you know, whatever he thought he had gone out to Vegas 4 years ago to be a success story, crashed and burned. He was, you know, disabled, living in very substandard housing and circumstance. And the law firm from Massachusetts sent me out there to notify him that his aunt had left him $33,000. And when I got to the door, and after I confirmed his identity, this place was not a place most people would like to tread. And this fellow, very nice, offered me a seat at his table, and he said, "You know, Frank, I could really use a couple of $300 because I'm living on $380 a month on my disability check." And when he found out that he was the recipient of $33,000, going to be the recipient of $33,000, I mean, that reaction was priceless. That was,
I'm sure.
You know, just that it's the nature of the work, I guess, that provides its own rewards along the way. So we may get a little bit jaded by one set of bad news after another coming in the door, but we'd like to think that if it's there, we're going to find it, and these people will be using attorneys that know how to use the information for a positive result.
Yeah, so a lot of the meaning is in the outcome, in the best possible outcome, kind of like in my work. Well, Frank, thank you so much for being here tonight. This has really been interesting. It helps me, and I'm sure our listeners, get a much better sense of how and when they would use a private investigator, and hopefully demystified the whole thing. And I'm wondering, Frank, how can people, what would be the best way for people to reach you?
Well, we have business locations both in New Hampshire and in Massachusetts. We've recently opened up associated offices on the Cape. And I guess the easiest way to reach us is we have a website, investigativeservicesllc.com. And our local phone number is 742-6669. And that could get a person started. And, you know, we're not adverse to answering our own phones and giving a person some time, you know, by a simple phone call to evaluate if there's something that we can do for them and if it would help their situation. We're not here to waste anybody's money or our time on stuff that doesn't help, because we count on that person carrying the message to someone that they're acquainted with if they need someone like us.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Frank. I really appreciate your being here tonight. This was great. I'm sure you're going to get a lot of calls. And we're going to have to wrap up now. We're less than a minute left.
Okay.
I want to thank all you listeners for tuning in. If you want more information about relationship issues, you can go to my website, howtobeabettercouple.com. Hopefully you'll contact Frank if you need a private investigator. He's wonderful. And my next show is Wednesday, February 23rd at 9 p.m., and it's called Chill Out, Easy Mind Body Relaxation Techniques, and it features Catherine Frick, an expert in the field. So, good night, Frank. Thanks again, and keep up the good work.
You're welcome. Good night.
All right. Take care.